For the Medical Journal of Australia, I'm Kate Swanell. Welcome to the MJA podcast. New research published in the MJA has shown that 2 in 3 young people with emerging mental disorders did not experience meaningful improvement in social and occupational functioning during 2 years of early intervention care. That's sobering news in a COVID-19 climate that has seen demand for mental health services rise by about 25%.
One really good side effect of the pandemic, if there is one, is that every single Australian is more sensitised to the fragility of their own mental health and that of their family.
That's the voice of Professor Patrick McGorry, Executive Director of Origin and a founding director of Headspace. He has written an editorial to accompany the new research, and in it he lays out the reality of mental health for young Australians. Professor McGorry is my special guest today. Now, the last time I spoke to you was back in, I think, May or June of last year, when Origin brought out some modelling about what you called the shadow pandemic of mental health.
Yes.
Has the reality lived up to the modelling?
Absolutely, almost exactly. We predicted a 30% increase in need for care across the lifespan, but especially in young people. And a paper published in The Lancet about 2 weeks ago showed that around the world, globally, you know, fantastic data sets were put together to show that, that there has been an increase in anxiety and depression just in 2020 alone of 25%. Mm. So if you add in other things like eating disorders and, you know, the other diagnoses, you'd definitely probably get to and exceed 30%. So I think we were pretty much spot on. It's like those numbers don't seem to count as much as the COVID numbers.
In terms of the attention it's getting from government, you mean?
Yeah. Any government. I mean, our government's been marginally better than most, but you know, I don't think anyone in other countries have paid much attention to this. And they've patted themselves on the back because the suicide rate hasn't gone up. You know, the actual death rate has not gone up yet. So that modelling has not actually been borne out yet. Still could the economic issues are the drivers of that as well. So in terms of a mental health system that was already broken and overwhelmed, I hear all these people talking about the COVID workers, the health workers dealing with COVID being overwhelmed. We're overwhelmed every single day of our lives, and we have been for decades. But it's got 25% worse.
Now, you've written an editorial for the MJA, and it's accompanying some new research from Iofino and colleagues, which is a bit sobering. It shows that, only about 35% of young people involved in a couple of interventions that the Brain and Mind Centre and Headspace were involved in had good results. The rest either deteriorated or had fluctuating results from it. What did you make of that research, and did it tell you anything you didn't already know?
That's a great question. It didn't tell me anything I didn't really already know, because Headspace was designed as a primary care initiative. In other words, you know, targeted on mild to moderate, you know, early stage presentations, and it's been very, very successful at that, creating access, trust, and engagement, and being able to deal with the sort of a short-term episode of care. That's what its financial model and concept is about. And it does that for about, as you say, 35% of the young people benefit and recover very well. The other 65% of what we call the missing middle, the people who can gain a good entry into care via primary care, just like anyone does in primary care, but they need more specialised care because they've got more complex and enduring conditions. And the problem is, of course, once beyond Headspace, there's a vast gulf and you cannot get that next step stage of care.
When you say the 65% are more complicated, in what ways are they more complicated? Do they have comorbidities, other conditions? What's going on there?
Yeah, that's exactly right. So what they are is they've got early signs of more serious conditions. Like I've seen a lot of young people, for example, in Headspace, myself in the pandemic, who are showing signs of an emerging quite serious eating disorder, young women. Early signs of psychosis, but not really had a psychotic break yet. Emerging bipolar, more severe forms of depression that aren't responding to the sort of a few sessions of psychological intervention and maybe some antidepressants. So so still not responding and probably getting worse. That sort of wave of increasing severity and complexity, and as you say, comorbidities, you know, mixed in, things mixed in together as well, which need a team-based approach, you know, like a psychiatry and other members of a multidisciplinary team need to be involved. So it's the second tier which hasn't been built. And so the only option for those people is to get worse and worse until they get into life-threatening situations and end up in emergency departments.
In your editorial, you talk about an intervention that was introduced in a limited fashion 10 years ago. Tell us about that intervention and tell us why it hasn't spread.
The first sort of phase of my own work and my team's work at Origin was in the 1990s, when we developed systems of care to detect and treat schizophrenia and psychotic illnesses. It was called EPIC and the early psychosis model. And that has gone around the world in the last 10 or 15 years, and it's in hundreds and hundreds of locations around the world, across the whole of the US, the UK, Denmark, and these sort of countries, as early psychosis programs. What we did 20 years ago when we set up Origin was to basically expand that focus beyond psychosis and to try to deliver it for all of the emerging mental illnesses in teenagers and young adults. So anorexia, disorders, and the like, personality disorders. So the early psychosis platforms in Australia have really been very limited in contrast to the other countries, despite the fact that it was invented here. We've only got 6 regions in Australia where these programs exist. They were set up from 2011, and they've produced fantastic results in those regions, better than anywhere in the world. But they haven't spread. It's been like an orphan program. In fact, in 2015, 2016, it was cut back by the federal government. Now, Greg Hunt salvaged it, and it's continued, and he's supporting it. But it's a glass ceiling. It needs to be across the whole country. And it needs to be expanded diagnostically to cover the other diagnoses, not just psychosis. So we have a model. We have a solution to the missing middle, but it's not it's just not been invested in or scaled up. But it could be. And we've been talking to the federal government and to the opposition about actually doing that, like releasing it and to solve this problem. We have the missing middle, which is, you know, hundreds of thousands of young people across the country. But we have the solution, and we're very keen to work with the federal government to actually make that happen. We can't rely on state governments to do it because they're still struggling to build the really acute end of the system. Even with the Victorian Royal Commission, that's going to be a big challenge, even for the Victorian government. And the other governments have shown little appetite at state government level for doing this anyway.
I'm chatting today with Professor Patrick McGorry from Origin and Headspace. Pat's editorial and the research by Iofino and colleagues are free to access at mja.com.au. The full web addresses for both articles are in the show notes of this podcast. We have some exciting news about the availability of this podcast. Apart from Apple Music and Spotify, you can now find us on Amazon Music and Audible, as well as iHeartRadio and Player FM. Just search for Medical Journal of Australia and hit the subscribe button, and you'll never miss an episode. Back to our chat with Pat McGorry. Greg Hunt's obviously got some clue about what the urgency is, but are you getting positive talk from the federal government, or are they just, you know, deflecting or whatever?
Well, I guess the proof of the pudding's in the eating, but I've had some pretty positive conversations with the Treasurer and with the Prime Minister about this, and with Mr. Hunt too, and with David Coleman. So I'm cautiously optimistic that we'll see, you know, an expansion. And Origin wants to play a leadership role here. We can't have fragmented commissioning of these services around Australia. This is the results are highly dependent on model fidelity. You know, so the reason the Australian regions are getting such good results, and the reason they get such good results in Denmark in particular, they found better results from real world implementation than they did in the original RCTs, which is a very unusual finding. Wow. So implementation of this depends on model fidelity. So we've got to have a central commissioning and fidelity structure which Origin would be keen with our history of expertise in this area to support the government in rolling out.
How's the workforce doing, Pat?
Well, I've been talking to my colleagues here at Origin and in Victoria. And also with Mr. Coleman, that workforce, alongside money, which is always the big, you know, rate limiting factor, but even when you have money, the workforce is now the number one risk to reform and to quality care. And there's been, you know, paralysis about workforce development for 20 years. We haven't done anything, you know, about workforce, and the system's just gradually imploded around the country. We've offered a number of solutions, very positive discussions, but with government, but there's got to be a sense of urgency here, because at the moment I have in our services in northwest of Melbourne 1,000 young people on our waiting lists, and we've actually got vacancies. Wow. We could employ people. We've got about 100 vacancies in our service, but with the borders shut and with, you know, a complete lack of any sort of entrepreneurial spirit in terms of, you know, recruitment and retention, we're struggling to actually find the people. I think there are lots of ways we could, in an emergency sense, a bit like how they did with COVID, find people to fill these holes, at least to hold the fort and to offer relief for the exhausted workforce that's already there. But we need a medium-term plan, which has got to open the bandwidth of training. You know, and this is where Commonwealth-funded places and universities is very important. They've got to be expanded dramatically. The colleges have got to really release the grip and allow more training positions and be more flexible about all the supervision and training arrangements too. This is an emergency. This is the biggest public health issue we're facing now over the post-pandemic period, the mental health challenge and the shadow pandemic. So trying to inject a sense of urgency here is what we've been trying to do.
So wave your magic wand, Pat. What would you do? Money, no object.
I think my friend Ian Hickey always says it's not about money now, it's about reform. But you can't have reform without money. And we're still only spending $10 billion a year on a 5 million person a year problem. We're spending $28 billion a year on the NDIS, which is for 500,000 people. So the mismatch in funding for mental health is still extreme. Ian's right in the sense that even when you have the money, if you don't solve the workforce and the reform structures, I agree with him. Just pouring money into the existing structures is not going to achieve where we the goals. We've got to actually build the structure, and the government is actually starting to do that. They're building these community-based hubs for children and adults, and we just need to expand the hub backup system for headspace in the youth area. If we did those three things and primed all of these new accessible models of care with skilled, compassionate workers, then it's definitely an achievable goal. It's not a wicked problem. The solutions are absolutely just waiting in the wings to be implemented.
Is there a message for GPs, Pat?
GPs, all credit to them and to the emergency departments. They're the only people that are actually willing to see people with mental health problems at the moment. Everybody else is full and inaccessible. The GPs are crucial, and the government did actually bring in a diploma, you know, like a diploma of psychological medicine, I think, reviving that old concept from 30, 40 years ago. So the GPs could actually get more skills. And I think a one-year course like that would add tremendous value to the capacity of GPs. But the GPs need support. The GPs that I know are very willing to actually work in with people with mental ill health. In fact, it's a big chunk of their practice, but they don't get any support. There's no backup system for them. Same with Headspace. Headspace doesn't have a backup system. So what we need is that second tier for adults, and for the headspaces for young people, and for the GPs with young people too. So that it's this second tier thing which works well with GPs and can actually employ GPs in these platforms too. So I value the GPs very, very highly, but they just need more support. If you're seeing people just for 15 minutes and you haven't got the space or maybe in many cases the training to do the psychological sort of work, and you can't get access to skilled psychologists because the better access, because it's all full, they're booked out for months ahead, what are you going to do? I mean, we just need a much stronger sort of integrated care system, vertically integrated. So the GPs have got very fluid access to the next tier of expertise. They tend to have that for other specialties. So why can't we have it in mental health? One really good side effect of the pandemic, if there is one, is that every single Australian is more sensitized to the fragility of their own mental health and that of their family. And with the 25% increase in cases, we've also seen a big loss of well-being and morale, especially in Sydney and Melbourne, where there have been extreme lockdowns for long periods. So I think that's working in our favour. The public now expect government to act. There are definitely sympathetic leaders in state and federal governments around the country. We need to be the wind beneath their wings to actually help them to invest and basically go with the blueprints that we're offering and not get confused by mixed messages from the sector. That's been a problem in the past, you know, sector basically giving government sort of confusing messages. Well, I think the message is really clear. We've got the solutions. We've got the blueprints. The Victorian Royal Commission produced a pretty good one in a structural sense. So there's no real barrier to actually solving this problem. Australia is the country in the world where we're most likely to do it because we're more aware and we're more there's more momentum, and we've got better people to deliver the solutions than anywhere else in the world too. So I feel optimistic, but it's obviously a political question. Will it actually get done?
My thanks to my special guest today. Don't forget that all our podcasts are open access and available at www.mja.com.au/podcasts. Or you can subscribe to our feed at iTunes. My name's Kate Swanell, and we'll see you next time.